Good evening, everyone. Today is Sunday, November 16th, 2025. Today is the last teleseminar for the season. So hopefully we'll have some good discussion today. Before we get started, I just wanted to ask if anybody has any concerns or issues they'd like to bring up. We don't have that many people on the call right now. So I have somebody with a area code of 469. Area code 469, do you have any question, any comment, concern, a case you'd like to bring up?
I don't have anything specific. I was hoping to just be a listener, but if you give me a couple minutes, I could come up with something if that's necessary.
It's, you know, it's up to you. Like I said, there's only a handful of people on the call, so I can bring up a topic.
Just give me a couple minutes and I'll look through my list right now.
All right, cool. All right, so I'm just going to bring up just some topics to kind of go over things that I've kind of, when I do the mock worlds, there's been some issues. Again, like I said, this is the last teleseminar. I know the exam's in a few weeks. So just going to go over a couple little topics, and if you have something, just chime back in. I have you actually on an open mic, 469.
Okay.
So just bring it up, okay? So a topic I'm going to bring up that I've noticed when I do some of the mock orals, there's been some concerns or issues, and if anybody sees anything that I'm saying out of turn, please chime in, is in regards to ectopic pregnancy and methotrexate regimens. I think there's an entire practice bulletin on this. That's number 193. So definitely there'll be in some way, shape, or form some type of question for ectopic, either in your case list or on a structured case. So for everyone on the call, in a synopsis of that practice bulletin, a single HCG measurement cannot diagnose viability or location of the gestation.
And you're much smaller.
And I'm just going to mute here. Okay. All right. Perfect. So a single HCG measurement cannot diagnose viability or location of a gestation. A serial HCG concentration measurements are used to differentiate normal from abnormal pregnancies. When clinical findings suggest an abnormal gestation, a second HCG measurement is recommended 2 days after the initial measurement. That is, the patient is stable. You may have a thought that she is an ectopic. Unless you clearly see an ectopic pregnancy with a fetal heartbeat or embryo, fetal pole, I should say, yolk sac, because somebody could have an adnexal mass, it could be a corpus luteal, so not necessarily an ectopic. So the recommendation is you need to have two measurements, okay? Therapy should not be initiated in a hemodynamically stable woman on the basis of a single beta HCG agent to the beta HCG level. A pregnancy of unknown location should not be considered a diagnosis, but it's a transient state. Okay? In women undergoing uterine aspiration secondary to a pregnancy of unknown location, usually we have an HCG decrease of at least 50%, 50, within 12 to 24 hours. And according to that practice bulletin, there's debate among experts about the need to undergo an aspiration before giving the methotrexate. You have that discriminatory zone, that's 3,500. Realistically, your HCG should roughly double every 48 hours. So if a patient comes in, making this up, with a level of 300, in 48 hours she should be at a 600. So it's going to be difficult to see anything at a level of 300 unless she's downtrending, let's say had an ectopic or something and downtrending. Or the same thing if she had passed some tissue unbeknownst to her, you could have that going down as well. So that's why you want that second level in 48 hours. In regards to the single dose methotrexate, it is 50 milligrams per meter squared body surface area. That's given IM, intramuscular, on day one. Okay? Day one, the day you give the medication. And then you measure the ATG on day four and day seven. If there is a decrease of greater than 15%, then you do your monitoring weekly thereafter. So then you'll check again on day 14, day 21, day 28, and she should be getting a 15% decrease each week thereafter. At any point she does not, that means she's had a treatment failure. Everybody always tells me treatment failures from day four to day seven. Well, then what's the point of then monitoring her continuously? See where I'm coming from? So she should have that continued 15% decrease. She has the treatment failure for that one injection. She can get another injection of the single dose regimen. So you would give her that 50 milligrams per meter squared IM, and you follow weekly at that point as well. If the HSC does not decrease after two doses, you consider surgical management. Up to date indicates a third dose may be administered prior to surgical consideration. Again, that's up to date. The practice bulletin says two doses. And then you have the two-dose regimen. You administer 50 milligrams per meter squared IM on days one and day four. So automatically you get two injections. Once you decide on a regimen, you don't flip-flop. She either stays in the single dose or two dose. Okay? So in the two dose, she gets the same 50 milligrams per meter squared on day one and day four. You check that HCG level on day four and day seven. A decrease of greater than 15%, you start measuring your HCGs weekly till zero. If the decrease is less than 15%, you readminister the methotrexate 50 milligrams per meter squared IM on day seven, and check the HCG level on day 14. If it decreases greater than 15% between day 7 and day 11, continue to monitor weekly till zero. If the decrease is less than 15%, you administer another 50 milligram per meter squared on day 11, and you check HCG on day 14. If the HCG does not decrease after four doses, you consider surgery. It has a comparable risk of adverse effects as single-dose protocol, okay? There was a statistically significant higher success rate for the two-dose regimen in patients with initial ACG levels between 3,600 and 5,500 and non-statistically significant trend of greater success for the two-dose regimen with an initial ACG of greater than 5,000. So if you have a patient with a higher ACG, higher mass, perhaps there's fetal cardiac activity, greater chance of failure, you want to give that two-dose regimen, okay? Then you have your fixed dose. That's going to be weight-based, surgical scar ectopic. Could it be a corneal ectopic, cervical ectopic, cesarean scar ectopic, I said. So you administer methotrexate, 1 milligram per kilogram IM, and that's going to be on even days, day 1, 3, 5, and 7. And you alternate with folinic acid or leucovorin, 0.1 milligrams per kilogram IM on the even days, 2, 4, 6, and 8. You measure your HCG level on methotrexate dose days and continue until HCG has decreased by 15% from the prior level. So if you have a decrease of greater than 15%, you discontinue the methotrexate at that point, and then you measure your HCG levels weekly until zero. So you may have to give her 1, 2, 3, or 4 doses. So you give that first injection, day one. Day two, you give leucovorin. On day three, before you give her an injection, you check the beta HCG. If it's a more than 15% decrease, you're done giving her the injection. You start your monitoring. If it's less than a 15% decrease, give her the next injection, weight-based. The next day, day four, you give the leucovorin. Then you go to your day five, check your HCG beforehand, check it, and see what it shows. Okay? So hopefully that makes sense. If the HCG does not decrease you after four doses, consider surgery. Up to date says you can give a fifth dose prior to any surgical consideration. Again, that's not what the practice bulletin says. It's what up to date says. I have a small group. I have everybody's mics open. Does anybody have any questions in regards to that?
In regards to the cesarean scar act topic,
yep.
I know I do. I have a couple of those on my case list. I don't usually use methotrexate for these,
right?
But and I'll definitely be able to explain it if that comes up as an option. But when you're explaining your rationale with like a low level of cramping and bleeding with using methotrexate, deciding when to go to the operating room or not, are there any principles we should keep in mind? Of course, like imaging.
You're saying in general or a cesarean scar topic? Just in general?
In general would probably, yeah, that would probably be applicable for a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, the issue when you give methotrexate, there is that possibility with the medication working, you start getting spasm of the, for lack of a better word, the fallopian tube. It does have some muscle in it. It starts spasming. You may get some bleeding from the fimbriated end. So you may have a patient come in pain, and she may have a little bit of free fluid. So what's the first thing you're thinking? She's ruptured. And she possibly could be, right? So you got to have in your differential that she's ruptured. So that always has to be paramount. So one option that you can do, now if she had a massive amount of free fluid, she's unstable, that's different. But a gal who has, you know, some discomfort, she has a little bit of free fluid, not much, could it be just the medication working? I've seen cases, and I've done it myself, where we admit the patient for serial exams to make sure she doesn't have an acute abdomen. And then, you know, you give her some pain medicine to kind of ride over as the medication kicks in for pain medicine. And then hopefully her HNH is stable and you avoid a surgery. If she's not ruptured, she's going to be stable. Does that make sense? But it's sometimes a very hard. Sometimes they come in hollering in pain. I remember many times, you know, run into the operating room thinking she's ruptured, she has the free fluid, and everything's intact. Does that make sense? So there's nothing wrong with observing the patient.
Yeah.
Unless the patient's like, hey, I can't take it. I'm nervous. I'm concerned. It could be ruptured. Let's go to the operating room.
Yeah, fair.
And then, of course, there's that option because for the most part, if somebody goes to the operating room, she's going to lose a tube on that side. Let's be honest. However, you can do a salpingostomy where you can, you know, with point cautery, you inject some vasopressin in that area, point cautery, you know, open up the fallopian tube and the anti-mesenteric side and see if you could take out that pregnancy, that tissue. But the thing is, some could be left behind, so you have to monitor the patient postoperatively. You leave the tube open by secondary intention. Cases that now, they have all that VistaSeal. You have all those, you know, things that you can place to stop bleeding. I know when people do that type of procedure, they'll put like the VistaSeal on the tube to help the process of any bleeding, and then they follow the patient with HCGs because you could have left a piece behind that'll take effect, and then the HCGs start increasing. At that point, then you have to, you know, give her methotrexate, but she saves her tubes. And you do see patients that may have, you know, a prior salpingectomy, and she doesn't have the other side. Does that make sense? Any other questions in regards to, go ahead, please.
No, I said that was really helpful. I had a similar case on my case list, so I'm helpful to know how to kind of show that logic.
Yeah, and, you know, and in the end, you know, you have your surgical management and your medical management. So the question is, do you need to have tissue diagnosis before you give methotrexate? Not very clear. So I think it's a shared decision-making with the patient. Some patients say, yeah, I'll take the medicine. Some people are like, I don't feel comfortable. And they'd like to have surgery. But that being said, if you have a level, I'm making this up here, of 3,500, which is a discriminatory zone, and she shows up 48 hours, and she's stable, and she has a level of 4,000, so 3,500 to 4,000, that is not an appropriate increase. So I've had candidates say, well, I will follow her up again in another week. Is that the right answer? No. You know, she may want this pregnancy. I don't see a problem. If she's stable, to follow her up again in another 48 hours, and let's say she gets 4,100. At that point, you have to say, hey, it's going to be either DNC or, you know, a manual vacuum aspiration, or go for your laparoscopy. Because to be following, it has to be a shared decision-making also with the patient, saying, hey, the longer you wait, the less effective the methotrexate can be, because it's going to be going higher and higher. Does that make sense? So hopefully that makes sense. We have a small group. Anybody on the call have any question, topic, concern that they'd like to bring up? Because we did not have any questions for this session. Nobody put anything in. Any questions? It's an open mic, so you can just jump in. Nobody's chiming in. Everybody has all their questions answered. All righty. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
I have a handful of cases where I was curious about what you think the most appropriate answer to decision-making around the ovaries post-menopause might be. And I know the, like, recent literature has been a little bit mixed. What do you think would be, like, a reasonable and conservative board's answer around at the time of hysterectomy? I'm a Eurovine fellow. We do a lot of hysts in older populations post-menopause.
Right.
But what you think would be a reasonable answer about pure decision-making around the ovaries?
I think that you hit the nail on the head there. Definitely it's going to be shared decision-making. You know, I'm assuming, I mean, because I know when I took the exam, you had to say, well, we would keep the ovaries in situ till the age of 65, which I always thought was kind of like, that's a long period of time. Because there was a study that showed there was an increase in the all-case mortality that they were attributing to some cardiac issues. So now, depending on who you read, first thing I would never bring up on this exam, the data, the literature, because they can ask you, okay, what study? You know,
that
making
sense.
So now you're stuck. So is it easier to say, to my understanding, as per ACOG, because you're just like you're referencing the practice bulletin, right? As per ACOG and the practice bulletin or the clinical consensus, that's what they're called now, aren't they? I don't know what they're calling these weird abbreviations. So it would be a shared decision making. So again, depending on your read, who you read, some people are saying age of 55. If somebody's greater than the age of 55, the recommendation is now to remove them. ACOG has not gone to that yet. Some of their literature is still saying that 65, so they haven't changed it. But I know one of the maintenance of certification articles of the last couple of years brought up that study that questioned this all-cause mortality, the all-case mortality of removing the ovaries less than 65, had some fundamental statistical issues with it. So that's why they had us read this maintenance of certification article, and they're saying it's greater than 55. I know some people bring a shared decision making of greater than 45 to the patient. And that's the way it was when I was a resident years ago. Anybody less than 40, you kept the ovaries. Between 40 to 45, it's discussed with the patients, whatever she'd like. And anything greater than 45, you recommend removal of the ovaries. I think you'd be very safe doing it at the age of 55, no questions asked. Am I making sense?
Yeah. Yep, that makes total
sense.
Perfect. Yeah.
You're gonna deal with a lot of older women. So if you're gonna do something vaginal, do a vaginal hysterectomy, hopefully everything has a significant prolapse, take that uterus out pretty easily, and then you can focus on those ovaries. That being said, if you cannot get the ovaries, according to ACOG, to my understanding, and the last time I reviewed that practice bulletin, you're not supposed to change route of hysterectomy if you can't do a salpingectomy.
Yeah, that's
an example.
Too, so I just wanted to make sure.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. Okay, perfect. Great.
Does that help?
Great. That's in line with what I was assuming,
so,
and that really helps.
And I would just say shared decision making. You know,
yeah.
I've seen cases where the patient's 42. She gives, they give a family history of breast cancer, but her genetic testing's negative, and you still did her BSO. 42. I don't know. I'm not the patient. You know what I'm saying? So did you do something wrong? If the patient wants the ovaries out, as long as she understands her risks, and it's not the same to be taking the hormone replacement as being on, you know, your own body doing the hormones itself. You know what I'm saying? But again, it's shared decision making. And if that's what the patient wants. Less than 40, and she has really no documented carrier of a genetic disorder that would increase your risk for ovarian cancer, uterine cancer, I don't know why you would do that. These procedures. Am I making sense? You should keep those ovaries in. Again, unless, you know, it's BRCA. BRCA has different standards, you know. Does that answer the question? That's a vague area.
That's perfect, yeah.
That's a vague area. And and really, the practice bulletins have not moved up. It's unfortunate because a lot of the practice bulletins are really obese, you know, focused. Not much GYN. I know they were talking about, you know, PMDD last year. A couple of years before, it was a couple of osteoporosis treatment of osteoporosis management, you know, diagnosis. Not a really sink your teeth in. Because I'd be interested to know what ACOG's stance is clearly, without question, in regards to this. But again, shared decision-making. When in doubt, the patient said, unless it's something so absurd that the patient's not rational, you know? You know, she's 19 years old. She had one day of lower abdominal pain. She wants a hysterectomy. That's absurd, right? So as long as it's a, you know, it makes sense with shared decision-making.
Awesome. That's super helpful. Thank you
all right.
so much.
Yeah, no worries. Anybody else on the call have an item to bring up or concern? Again, small group, we only have a handful on the call. Yeah, giving you guys the opportunity. Nobody has another item to bring up because I can bring up another topic in the same vein as HCG monitoring. Talk about a molar pregnancy, okay? Because you're following your HCGs there as well. So if you have a partial or a complete mole, okay? So what's the difference between the two? So a complete mole is completely derived paternally. It is 46XX or 46XY, okay? Partial mole, not so. It's a normal ovum that's fertilized by two sperm or occasionally a diploid sperm, and that's a triploid or triploid. I'm assuming it's triploid. 69XX or 69XXY. The complete mole has that snowstorm appearance, very clear. There's no fetal parts. There could be fetal parts with a partial mole. Okay? The risk of GTN. Remember, when you have a molar pregnancy, you're at greater risk for GTN. You do not have GTN. That's why you have to follow her, okay? So the risk of GTN for a complete mole is 15 to 20%. With a partial mole, it's 1 to 5%, okay? Also, with a complete mole, you have the higher HCG levels, okay? So greater risk of hyperemesis, fecal luteum cysts, early preeclampsia at less than 20 weeks, hyperthyroidism as well. There are some stains that can differentiate between the two, but I think that's a little bit detailed. I don't think for the purpose of this exam, it's something that you would need to know. That's really, really getting in the weeds. Okay? So a patient has a molar pregnancy. Regardless of the type, the recommendation is evacuation, so a suction DNC. She's going to be at greater risk for bleeding, so you've got to be prepared with uterotonics, possible intrauterine Foley catheter placement if the bleeding doesn't stop. Usually the uterotonics do their trick. As well, if she is done with childbearing, they would prefer, if possible, to do a hysterectomy. Okay? Don't evacuate. Go straight to hysterectomy. Who has a greater risk of molar pregnancy, younger spectrum and the older spectrum, women in their 40s, okay? So if she's done childbearing, she's 45, she wants a hysterectomy, that's the recommendation, okay? So there is no practice bulletin in regards to the molar pregnancies. That has been pulled, not been replaced. So the info I'm giving here is actually from up to date, which a lot of people have accepted. From my understanding, the last time I saw anything on FIGO, they were saying you would monitor your complete moles for 6 months. Somebody told me that apparently there's something new. I don't have access to that. I haven't reviewed it. I didn't have access to this statement or article saying it's going to be 3 months. So I think between 3 and 6 months of monitoring would be sufficient. Let me go into a little bit more detail. So in essence, she has the suction DNC. You start monitoring her on a weekly basis on her HCG level. Okay? The HCG level is monitored weekly till zero. Okay? Once it hits zero with a partial mole, you follow for one more month, make sure it stays zero. And with the complete mole, like I said, 3 months, up to date says 3 months, and they're basing it, again, don't say studies, literature, data. A big study that they did in England that said or showed that you can follow just for the 3 months, because they're saying the risk of GTN once she's at zero and just being followed monthly decreases significantly, especially for a partial mole. So that's why I say you can follow for 3 months than just for the complete mole. If you said 6 months, I think that's more than sufficient. During that time frame that you're monitoring the patient, she has to be on reliable birth control, because if she gets pregnant, you're not going to be able to differentiate if this is the mole persisting and it could be GTN or it's a brand new pregnancy because it's just going up. So what's the range or what's a clinical scenario that you may have an issue with that there could be a possible association with post-molar GTN? So if you have an increasing HCG of greater than 10% across three values over a two-week period, or a plateauing HCG, four measurements that remain within plus or minus 10% over at least a three-week period. So both those cases. Okay? So decreasing an appropriate HCG, you want a decrease of greater than 10%, 10, while ectopic is 15, 15. See the difference? So decrease an appropriate HCG decrease of greater than 10% across four values during a three-week period. So I'm making this up, day 1, day 7, day 14, day 21. Now, let's say she hit zero and you're doing the monthly checks. At any point she's increasing, that's it. That's, there's something wrong because she was at zero and now she's going up. So she's either pregnant again or post-molar GTN. So definitely oncology would have to be involved. Okay? Like I said, FIGO, the last time I checked, said check for 6 months if you're a complete mole. Some, I did a couple of candidates, mock orals are saying that they have read that FIGO is saying now it's 3 months. So I don't have a comment on that. I know up to date clearly says FIGO says 6 months. And then there's a WHO prognostic scoring system that's to see the risk of resistance to single agent chemo. You can treat it with methotrexate or atenomycin. So that includes the age, the type of antecedent pregnancy, the interval between the pregnancy and getting the GTN, because anybody's at risk realistically. You could be with an ectopic, you could have, it's very rare, but even if you had an ectopic pregnancy, there's that possibility. ACG level, site of Mets, so a score of less than 6 or 7, depending on who you read, again, I'm not an oncologist, suggests a low risk of resistance to single agent chemo. Okay, so any questions in regards to the molar pregnancy? So I think you got to know how to be the serial checks. That's important. And then also the differences between the two different types of moles. I think that's very important to know as well. That could be, you know, if you have that on your case list or a structured case. Go ahead, please.
I have a quick question. If a patient has a hysterectomy instead of the suction DNC, do they still need that HCG monitoring protocol?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, definitely. I actually know of a case where, believe it or not, the patient had metastasis to her inner ear of the GTN. How's that possible? She did.
Wow.
So, very treatable. She actually got, pinpoint radiation in that area, plus the methotrexate, and responded very nicely to it. Yeah. So to my understanding, yes. Again, I'm not an oncologist. This is from when I was a resident 20 years ago. I have not seen a molar pregnancy in several years, especially in regards to the monitoring. But very, very chemosensitive. Yeah. But to my understanding, yes. Again, if they're asking you stuff like that, you're doing well. Go ahead.
Yeah. I know this is probably too into the weeds, but if a patient did get pregnant, would you, definitely with oncology, but is it more likely that you'd counsel them towards termination so you can monitor for GTN or allow them to have a pregnancy that would put them at higher risk?
That's a tough one. That's a tough one. That's a shared decision making for the patient. Because some patients, if they're put into that scenario, they'll want to, I don't want to call it terminate, but they would like a suction DNC because what if it is GTN? You know what I'm saying? If it shows just regular chorionic villi, it was another pregnancy. Now, I know of a case personally where a gal had come in and we couldn't find a pregnancy at all. And it was a pretty high level. But when you go deep down in her history, she had had a molar pregnancy like a year before. So it was, I was in a small hospital. We transferred her to a larger center. This was years ago. It was like, they were thinking with another pregnancy. It was a new pregnancy and not GTN. They thought it was a new pregnancy, but it wasn't. They were thinking it was GTN. And I don't know what transpired. We kind of lost it because it was she had to go to a different state because it was such a small place that we were at.
Oh, wow.
So everybody's thinking it's a regular pregnancy and then you can't find anything. And her level was pretty high. It was like 10,000. Couldn't find anything. You monitored her again. It was going up still. And then it was like 10,000, 10,500 type of thing. And it's like, so what do we do? So they were thinking it was actually GTN. So I can't tell you. They probably did a DNC, started doing like scans. We have better PET scans and all that stuff. I'm not an expert when it comes to any of this oncology stuff. But yeah, it's a good question.
Okay,
but yeah, I would suspect. Yeah. I do have another topic if anybody wants to be part of the hot seat, because I want to ask somebody in regards to this question. And it's an OB question. I know I had a urogyne on the call. What's your area code, urogyne? You still on the call, urogyne, or did I lose you?
I'm the 404. I'm on a train, so 404? I may be in and out, but I'm happy to try.
Let me ask you a question, because you have a different perspective than everybody else, I'm assuming, on the call that's not urogyne. So when you have a patient who has had a history of an OASIS, I'm noticing this with some candidates in my mock orals this season. It's interesting. It's just like certain things just they bunch together. She has a history of an OASIS. How would you counsel the patient in regards to future mode of delivery? As a urogyne, what would you recommend to this patient?
Yeah, I think the ACOG recommended answer would be I would counsel her that her risk of recurrence is still less than 50%. I believe it's between 10 and 20%, but that it would be an option.
So let me interject here. Let me interject here. The practice bulletin clearly says the risk of OASIS is 3 to 5%.
Okay.
So continue your discussion. Say again. But, of course, if you win that 5%, it's not going to be a good life, right? If you're going to be soaring on yourself. But continue. I just want to see the perspective of a urogynecologist.
I would use shared decision-making and offer her to elect for cesarean delivery versus a repeat vaginal delivery. And I think it would be fully based on her preferences and any remaining symptoms and sort of her recovery experience from her prior OASIS as well.
Correct, yes. If she has significant sequela from it, then maybe she should have a C-section, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the issue here is, let's say she's like, I understand that, doctor. I would like to try and have the baby naturally. What can you do? I know you're not an obstetrician, but what can you do as an obstetrician to in order to decrease that risk of oasis the second time around or third time around, however many babies she's had?
Mm-hmm.
Any recommendations there from Urogyn?
I would recommend perineal massage towards the end of her pregnancy, and then I would recommend the use of warm compresses intrapartum during the second stage.
Is there anything else that could be done in order to decrease her risk?
I can't think of another evidence-based recommendation other than perineal massage and compresses.
So let me ask you this. Anything as an obstetrician that you could do for that patient other than what you've already said?
I would recommend that if she had, I don't think a history of an oasis, actually don't know the answer, whether it's an indication for a third trimester growth or not, but I think an accurate...
Let me interject, let's just be...
Yeah.
And I think that's a good idea. If she says, this baby's way bigger than my other one,
right,
it doesn't bode well, right? But that being said, I know in clinical practice, because I've done it too, in clinical practice, we induce patients because we think the baby's on the bigger side. We don't want the baby to get bigger. That is not ACOG stance, okay?
Right.
Please, on this exam, do not say I induced her because I was concerned for, you know, LGA, if you want to say LGA, but LGA or SGA is a post-delivery diagnosis, but suspected macrosomia, then they open the door of what is macrosomia, and that practice bulletin is not very clear. Depends. It's either between 4,000 to 5,000 grams. If it's, you know, not diabetic, it could be greater than 5,000 grams. Diabetic, 4,500. And in other places, it says not diabetic, greater than 4,500. Diabetic, 4,000. So what's the right answer? Mm-hmm. Do not know. But please don't say, I induced her because I was concerned for macrosomia. Wrong thing to do in this exam. That is not an indication to induce a patient. But I don't see a problem doing a third trimester. You know, if they say she had, you know, a 7-pound baby and had an oasis, and now, and it might have been positional, could have been OP, what have you. Now she has an 8.5-pound baby. Not good, right?
Yeah.
Anything else? Anything else? Can I open up to everybody else on the call? Anything else you would recommend? Go ahead. Would you say, I'm sorry?
Oh, I just said not that I can think of.
Okay. Anybody else on the call?
Yeah.
Anybody else on
left lateral and right lateral recumbent instead of lithotomy?
It's possible. It's possible. Anything else? But I'm saying anything else as an obstetrician. You're there.
I would consider avoiding an operative vaginal delivery if that's what we're thinking of for mode of delivery.
Yeah. Very good. Very good. I think that's a good answer too. Anything else? And I'm assuming everybody on the call graduated within the last, what, four years at most? I'm assuming. Am I wrong in that assessment? If you graduated, you know, before 4 or 5 years ago, can you chime in? So I'm thinking everybody on the call, like I said, I only have a handful of you. Did their residency within the last 5 years, correct? I don't see anybody chiming in, so I'm assuming.
Are you trying to get at an episiotomy?
That's what I would do. Nobody ever tells me that. Now, then I'm told, well, according to, you know, the literature and all that, again, now you're stuck. You shouldn't be talking about literature. How can you really do these type of studies? I have seen cases where they'll do a vacuum on a patient. Kid's right there instead of doing an episiotomy. I think a vacuum is more, could be more at risk for the baby, especially that no matter how good you are at a vacuum, there's always a possibility you may cause trauma to that baby. And once you see a subgleal hematoma in real life, you're like, dude, I never want to see that ever again. It is freaky scary. Baby's head's like mush, scary, because it starts bleeding so quickly. So episiotomy and a right medial lateral episiotomy. And I think the reason, this is just talking to candidates, this season. The reason we're not seeing episiotomies is that we don't do episiotomies. We don't have much experience. When I ask somebody, how many episiotomies have you done? They're like zero or less than two. So if you don't feel comfortable, you cut this woman open to take out her baby, and you're scared of doing episiotomy? Now, somebody told me in one of the mock orals that I did, it was like, well, I was told if you say episiotomy, you're going to fail the exam. Okay, I've not heard that. That is part of our armamentarium and the regimen of, like, hopefully, that tissue is weak. So she is going to have a propensity to tear in that area. You know what I'm saying? So if we could prevent that, the simplest way, you could, you know, perineal massage, heat to that area. I'm not saying don't do that. But what is wrong with doing a right medial lateral episiotomy? Not a midline, not a midline. The midline has that greater risk of an oasis because it can go straight down. Somebody told me, well, they're more painful. They can bleed more. It's not recommended. I'm like, okay, so what's the difference between an RML and a second degree laceration? She tore there too. She could bleed there too. So, you know what I'm saying? It just didn't make any sense to me. Anybody want to add to that? Because I think that's part of the armamentarium. When I have a patient with a history of an oasis and she wants to try and have it natural, I have no problem with that. But I do tell the patient, I'm going to be honest with you, if you want to decrease your risk of repeat oasis, the energy has to go somewhere. I'm going to put it to the side and hopefully we avoid this. Patient usually says, sounds like a plan. She already got, she's taking the risk of 3 to 5%. It's going to, you know, can you decrease it even more? I think so with doing that at peace. Again, right medial lateral or left medial lateral, depending on, you know, your right hand, your handedness, for lack of a better word, as a surgeon. Anybody have any comments in regards to that? Just chime in, please. Because I find that, to me, very perplexing how nobody ever says the episiotomy. So when I talk to older docs, they're like, yeah, episiotomy. Younger docs, no, that's not part of their wheelhouse. They don't mention it at all. So I find that kind of fascinating, what I've noticed. Does anybody have anything? What do you think area code 404 as a Eurogyn?
I mean, I think quite consistently consistent with how we were trained. I've only done two episiotomies, both for the sake of a shoulder and delivering the posterior arm. But yeah, I mean, that all makes sense clinically. And like you said, the force vectors have to go somewhere and have to tear something. So yeah, that makes total sense. It's helpful insight.
Right. And that being said, you brought up shoulder dystocia. Now, depending on who you read when it comes to shoulder dystocia, I mean, some people say your risk is 13. I read this recently, and I was like floored. They said it's up to a 30-fold increase of a repeat shoulder, way more than oasis. So this is in my practice. If I know a patient has had a previous shoulder dystocia and she wants to deliver vaginally, I tell her, you will get an episiotomy automatically, period, because I don't want to waste time trying to make an episiotomy with that head just stuck there. It is very hard to do. And everybody, you know, tension is going to be flying in that room. If you already know that she has that history, why wouldn't you do the right medial lateral episiotomy? You're ready to do that posterior shoulder in a heartbeat. You know what I'm saying? If your other techniques aren't working, your microbiots and your suprapubic pressure isn't working. Make sense? That's what I would do in my practice.
Yeah,
leaving it to chance, not going to help you. She's up to a 30-fold increase. That makes the oasis look little in comparison, 3 to 5%, 30-fold. Saying she can't, you know, a lot of times I see that in a lot of patients that, like, she had a previous shoulder, wants to do another vaginal delivery. It's her prerogative, but she needs, I mean, definitely I would be doing the most I can. I would have her in Mark Roberts prophylactically. A lot of people say that doesn't do anything. A lot of people do their deliveries that way. If you don't have that many shoulders, maybe that's the right thing to do. I don't know. I don't know what the right answer is. These are just very difficult things to prove. Anecdotally, it may work. But to tell you, it's proven, that's a difficult one, to say the least. Any other questions in regards to the episiotomy? So don't forget the episiotomy, okay? Because I think that you know, again, I trained where we did episiotomies extremely liberally. You do not get paid more to do an episiotomy, but I'd rather do an episiotomy than tell a patient, I'm so sorry, you got another fourth degree. And no matter, as you well know, area code 404, you could be the best repair of that fourth degree, and she still is having issues. Am I correct?
Yeah, definitely.
Because there's a lot of involvement when it comes to the bowel movement, the defecatory like process. There's like, do we really do anything with nerves when we like repairing the sphincter and all that? No. So hope to God it all heals up, right? So some stuff is left to chance, to say the least, you know? Anything else you'd like to add, 404, as a Urogyn?
No, that was super helpful. I mean, several times a year where I'm in training, we see really awful fistulas that won't heal from that indication. And we've got a couple people who are diverted right now waiting for repeat repairs. And it's rough. So, yeah, that's a hard problem to solve.
And that's shameful. That's shameful. Because that's just terrible for that patient, you know. And in some cultures, that patient will be ostracized for the rest of her life, you know. To my understanding, of course, we live in America. That's not, you know, she's going to have lots of issues, don't get me wrong. But she's not going to be ostracized in a small village. Everybody knows that she has this problem. And where does she have that capability to get it fixed? She won't, right?
Yeah, definitely.
You know. Okay. So fantastic. Thank you for letting me see what a Urogyn's perspective is. Thank you so much. So anybody have any comments, concerns about what we talked about? Any questions? I know we went over a minute here, but like I said, we have a handful of people. This is the last opportunity, the last teleseminar of the season. Anybody want to add anything on what we discussed today? Anything in general, anything about the exam?
I logged on a little bit late. What was the discussion about salpingostomy versus salpingectomy for an ectopic?
What was your question? I'm so sorry.
About salpingostomy versus salpingectomy for an ectopic. Is it a reasonable, like where I trained, we did not do salpingostomies. We exclusively did salpingectomies. And if that like in your practice and you know just at least how to counsel surrounding both options,
I mean, this is it would be a shared decision making. Of course, if you already had a salpingectomy on the other side, and she only has that one tube, and luckily it's not ruptured, or not completely, you know, swollen, edematous. Because sometimes you look at these tubes and it's like, dude, this is, I can't fix this, you know. So hopefully, when you look at the picture, like I always think of the Wheelis picture, the Atlas of Pelvic Surgery. It's this little bump over the anti-mesenteric aspect of the fallopian tube, and just make that little cut to make it look so easy, but in real life, it's not that easy. She has to be well aware of the need for monitoring of the HCG. That's essential. And the need of methotrexate if the salpingostomy, you left some tissue behind. Am I making sense? And it's not a guarantee she won't get another ectopic in that side, right? You hope to God, you know, you cross your fingers because it heals by secondary intention. You're not supposed to resuture it because that adds to more to the scarring. So it's in the wheelhouse. I know with the Vista Seal and those special things, we're putting that on top of those because you'll see a lot of these guys that do it MIGS. They're doing it with a lot of patients that have had, you know, prior ectopics. And then I've heard of cases that they luckily were subsequently pregnant afterwards, by luck, because she's at a higher risk for ectopic, of course. So that's, you know, and also the key here is you cut into the tube, she can start bleeding. So you should put some vasopressin, to my understanding, as well as a point cautery. I know if people use the hook. I think the hook is kind of traumatic. If you can have that point cautery with that little needle, I should say needle cautery, it'd be better. And supposedly the way it works, just make that small incision. It's just supposed to just open up where that out-pocketing is, and hopefully you could just grab the ectopic pregnancy out and then kind of irrigate to try and take any residual tissue. And then, of course, you got to follow her up with the betas and then make sure she's hemostatic, and that's why people put that Vista Seal and stuff. Did that answer
your
question?
Okay, awesome. Thank you so much. Yep.
Yeah, so shared decision-making because she has to put in – she's a poor individual for follow-up. then you can't, really shouldn't be doing a self-endoscopy, because you need to follow up, because God forbid, you left some tissue behind and it takes and it keeps growing. And in the end, she ends up with 2 surgeries, right? Okay.
Yep, that makes total sense. Awesome.
Other questions for everybody on the call? Any other questions? All righty. Well, I see I don't have any more questions. Well, guys on the call, really, really want to wish you the best of luck. I know it's hard when you're the last group, but hopefully just keep practicing, because that's what's key. Verbalization is key in this exam. And the more you practice, the quicker you are on your feet when they ask, because they're going to ask you questions you're not going to know the answer to. And, it's that kind of like a gotcha. So hopefully with your practicing, you get better in pivoting. And it's milliseconds. It's automatic in your mind in order to say, well, I can't get out of this paper bag. I'm going to have to say, let's move on to something else. Or say, I'm sorry, I can't think of anything at this time. I'll look it up and get back to you. So with that, I wish everybody the best of luck, a good rest of the night, and a good rest of the year, because the year is coming to an end. And a good, unfortunately, Thanksgiving, you can't enjoy it that much because you're still studying. But hopefully you'll have a good holiday. And unfortunately, by the time you get the result, it's already the new year probably. So it's unfortunate. Because I don't know if they even gotten the scores in for the first group yet. Has anybody heard that? Any of their friends gotten scores yet? Because I haven't heard of any prior candidates. I'd have to look into it. All righty. Any other questions before I let you guys go? All right. Well, I really appreciate it. I wish you guys the best of luck. And like I said, a good rest of the night. Thank you so much, and have a good night.
Thank you.
Thank you.